Did you think I just ditched you? She paused, frowning pensively.
At first I did think that. Something like that. And I think I hated you. Then I started asking around. When I found out you didn't even come back to the slum clinic, and that nobody saw you, I thought you must have been doing something important.
Important, I laughed. It wasn't a good laugh. It was bitter and angry. I tried to push those feelings away. I'm sorry, Carla. I couldn't get a message out. I couldn't let you know. I was out of my mind with worry that you'd hate me for leaving you like that.
When I heard about it, that you were in the jail, it kind of broke my heart. It was a very bad time for me. This business I was doing, it was starting to go wrong. It was so wrong, so bad, Lynn, that I think I'll never come back from it. And then I heard about you, and I was so... Well, everything changed, just like that. Everything.
I couldn't understand what she'd said. I was sure it was important, and I wanted to ask her more. But the lone figure was only a few meters away, and he approached us with slow, dignified steps. The moment was lost. He was indeed a holy man. Tall, lean, and tanned to a dark earth brown, he wore a loincloth and was adorned with dozens of necklaces, amulets, and decorative bracelets. His hair was matted in dreadlocks that reached to his waist. Balancing the long staff against his shoulder, he clasped his hands together in a greeting and a blessing. We greeted him in turn and invited him to sit with us.
"Do you have any charas?" he asked in Hindi. "I would like to smoke on this beautiful night."
I fished a lump of charas from my pocket and tossed it to him with a filter cigarette.
"The Bhagwan's blessing be upon your kindness," he intoned.
"And a blessing of the Bhagwan upon you also," Carla replied in perfect Hindi. "We are very happy to see a devotee of the Lord Shiva at this full moon."
He grinned, showing gaps in his teeth, and set to preparing a chillum. When the clay pipe was ready, he raised his palms to gain our attention.
"Now, before we smoke, I want to give you a gift in return," he said. "Do you understand?"
"Yes, we understand," I said, smiling to match the light in his eyes.
"Good. I give you both a blessing. My blessing will always stay with you. I give you this blessing in this way."
He raised his arms above his head and then bent over on his knees, touching his forehead to the sand with his arms outstretched. Kneeling upright again and raising his hands, he repeated the gesture several times while mumbling indistinct words. Eventually, he sat back on his feet, smiled the gap-toothed smile at us, and nodded for me to light the pipe. We smoked in silence. When the pipe was finished, I refused to accept the return of the lump of charas. Acknowledging the gift with a solemn bow of his head, the holy man stood to leave. As we looked up at him, he slowly raised his staff to point it at the almost full moon. At once, we saw and understood what he meant. The pattern on the surface of the moon, that in some cultures is called the rabbit, suddenly looked to both of us like a kneeling figure raising his arms in prayer. Chuckling happily, the sadhu walked away along the gentle dunes. "I love you, Carla," I said, when we were alone again. "I loved you the first second I saw you. I think I've loved you for as long as there's been love in the world. I love your voice. I love your face. I love your hands. I love everything you do. And I love the way you do everything. It feels like magic when you touch me. I love the way your mind works and the things you say. And even though it's all true, all that, I don't really understand it.
and I can't explain it, to you or to myself. I just love you. I just love you with all my heart. You do what God should do. You give me a reason to live. You give me a reason to love the world. She kissed me, and our bodies settled together on the yielding sand. She clasped her hands in mine, and with our arms outstretched above our heads, we made love, while the praying moon seduced the sea, luring the waves to crash and crumble on the charmed, unfailing shore. And for a week then, we played at being tourists in Goa. We visited all the beaches on the coast of the Arabian Sea, from Chapora to Cape Rama. We slept for 2 nights on the white gold wonder of Culver Beach. We inspected all the churches in the old Goa settlement. The festival of St. Francis Xavier, held on the anniversary of the saint's death every year, bound us in immense crowds of happy, hysterical pilgrims. The streets were thronged with people in their Sunday best clothes. Merchants and street stall operators came from all over the territory. Processions of the blind, the lame, and the afflicted, hoping for a miracle, rambled towards the Basilica of the Saint. Xavier, a Spanish monk, was one of the 7 original Jesuits in the order founded by his friend Ignatius Loyola. Xavier died in 1552. He was just 46 years old, but his spectacular proselytizing missions to India and what was then called the Far East established his enduring legend. After numerous burials and disinterments, the much-exhumed body of St. Francis was finally installed in the Basilica of Bom Jesus in Goa in the early 17th century. Still remarkably, some would say miraculously, well-preserved, the body was exposed to public view once in every 10 years. While seemingly immune to decay, the saint's body had suffered various amputations and subtractions over the centuries. A Portuguese woman had bitten off one of the saint's toes in the 16th century, in the hope of keeping it as a relic. Parts of the right hand had been sent to religious centres, as had chunks of the holy intestines. Carla and I offered outrageously extravagant bribes to the caretakers of the basilica, laughing all the while, but they steadfastly refused to allow us a peek at the venerable corpse. "Why did you do the robberies?" she asked me, on one of those warm nights of satin sky and rolling, malignant surf. "I told you. My marriage broke up and I lost my daughter. I cracked up and got into drugs. Then I did the robberies to feed my heroin habit."
"No, I mean, why robberies? Why not something else?"
It was a good question, and one that no one in the justice system, cops, lawyers, judge, psychiatrist, or prison governors, had ever asked me. I've thought about it. I've thought about it a lot. It sounds weird, I know, but I think TV had a lot to do with it. Every hero on TV had a gun. And there was something brave about armed robbery. I know there really isn't anything brave about it. It's a gutless thing to do, scaring people with a gun. But it seemed the bravest way to steal money then. I couldn't bring myself to hit old ladies over the head and steal their handbags or break into people's private houses. Robbery seemed fair somehow, as if I took a fair chance every time I did it, of being shot dead, by the people I robbed or by the cops. She watched me in silence, almost matching her breathing to mine. "And something else. There's one special hero in Australia."
"Go on," she urged.
"His name was Ned Kelly. He was a young guy who found himself on the wrong side of the local lawmen. He was tough, but he wasn't really a hard man. He was young and wild. He was set up mostly by cops who had a grudge against him. A drunken cop had a crush on his sister and tried to molest her. Ned stopped it, and that's when his trouble started. But there was more to it than that. They hated him for a lot of reasons.
mostly for what he represented, which was a kind of spirit of rebellion. And I related to him because I was a revolutionary.
They have revolutions in Australia?
She asked, with a puzzled laugh.
I never heard this.
Not revolutions, I corrected her. Just revolutionaries. I was one of them. I was an anarchist. I learnt how to shoot and how to make bombs. We were ready to fight when the revolution came, which it didn't, of course. And we were trying to stop our government from fighting the Vietnam War.
Australia was in the Vietnam War?
It was my turn to laugh.
Yeah. Most people outside Australia don't know it. But we were in the war, all the way with the USA. Australian soldiers died beside American soldiers in Vietnam, and Australian boys were drafted to fight. Some of us refused to go, just like the American draft resistors. A lot of guys went to jail because they wouldn't fight. I didn't go to jail. I made bombs and organized marches and fought the cops at the barricades. Until the government changed and they pulled us out of the war.
Are you still one?
Still one what?
Are you still an anarchist?
It was a hard question to answer, because it forced me to compare the man I'd once been with the man I'd allowed myself to become. Anarchists, I began, and then faltered. No political philosophy I ever heard of loves the human race as much as anarchism. Every other way of looking at the world says that people have to be controlled and ordered around and governed. Only the anarchists trust human beings enough to let them work it out for themselves. And I used to be that optimistic once. I used to believe and think like that. But I don't anymore. So, no. I guess I'm not an anarchist now.
And that hero, when you did the armed robberies, you identified with him?
With Kelly, Ned Kelly, yeah. I think I did. He had a gang of young guys, his younger brother and his two best friends. And they did these hold-ups, robbing people. The cops sent a hit squad after him. But he beat them, and a couple of cops got killed.
What happened to him?
They caught him. There was a shootout. The government declared war on him. They sent a trainload of cops after him, and they surrounded his gang at a hotel in the bush.
A hotel in a bush?
The bush. It's what we call the countryside in Australia. Anyway, Ned and his guys were surrounded by this army of cops. His best friend was shot in the throat and killed. His kid brother and another kid named Steve Hart shot each other with their last bullets rather than let themselves be captured. They were 19 years old. Ned had this armor made from steel, a helmet and a chest plate. He came at them, the army of cops, with both guns blazing. He frightened the shit out of them at first, and they ran away. But their officers drove them back to the fight. They shot Ned's legs out from under him. After a phony trial with false statements from witnesses, Ned Kelly was sentenced to death.
Did they do it?
Yeah. His last words were, "Such is life." That was the last thing he said. They hanged him and then cut off his head and used it as a paperweight. Before he died, he told the judge who'd sentenced him that they'd meet very soon in a higher court. The judge died not long after. She was watching the story in my face as I told it. I reached out for a handful of sand and let it run through my fingers. Two large bats passed over our heads. They were close enough for us to hear the dry leaf rustle of their wings. I loved the Ned Kelly story when I was a kid. I wasn't the only one. Artists and writers and musicians and actors have all worked on the story in one way or another. He put himself inside us, in the Australian psyche. He's the nearest thing we've got to Che Guevara,
or Emiliano Zapata. When my brain got scrambled on heroin, I think I started to drown in a fantasy of his life and mine. But it was a messed up version of the story. He was a thief who became a revolutionary. I was a revolutionary who became a thief. Every time I did a robbery, and I did a lot of them, I was sure the cops would be there and I'd be killed. I was hoping it would happen. I played it out in my mind. I could see them calling me to stop, and I'd reach for a gun and they'd shoot me dead. I was hoping the cops would shoot me down in the street. I wanted to die that way. She reached out to put an arm around my shoulders. With her free hand, she held my chin and turned my head to face her smile.
"What are the women like in Australia?" she asked,
running her hand through my short blonde hair. I laughed and she punched me in the ribs.
"I mean it. Tell me what they're like."
"Well, they're beautiful," I said, looking at her beautiful face. "There's a lot of beautiful women in Australia. And they like to talk, and they like to party. They're pretty wild, and they're very direct. They hate bullshit. There's nothing like an Australian woman for taking the piss out of you."
"Taking your piss?"
"Taking the piss," I laughed. "Letting the air out of your chest, you know, ridiculing you. Stopping you from getting too many big ideas about yourself. They're great at it. And if they stick a pin in you to let a bit of hot air out, you can be pretty certain you had it coming." She lay back on the sand with her hands clasped behind her head.
"I think Australians are very crazy," she said. "And I would like very much to go there."
And it should have been as happy, it should have been as easy, it should have been as good forever as it was in those Goan days and nights of love. We should have built a life from the stars and the sea and the sand. And I should have listened to her. She told me almost nothing, but she did give me clues. And I know now that she put signs in her words and expressions that were as clear as the constellations over our heads. But I didn't listen. It's a fact of being in love that we often pay no attention whatsoever to the substance of what a lover says, while being intoxicated to ecstasy by the way it's said. I was in love with her eyes, but I didn't read them. I loved her voice, but I didn't really hear the fear and the anguish in it. And when the last night came and went, and I woke at dawn to prepare for the trip back to Bombay, I found her standing at the doorway, staring at the great shimmering pearl of the sea.
"Don't go back,"
she said, as I put my hands on her shoulders and kissed her neck.
"What?"
I laughed.
"Don't go back to Bombay."
"Why not?"
"I don't want you to."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"Just what I said. I don't want you to go."
I laughed because I thought it had to be a joke. "Okay," I said, smiling and waiting for the punchline. "So, why don't you want me to go?"
"Do I have to have a reason?" she demanded.
"Well, yeah."
"It just so happens I do have reasons, but I'm not going to tell you."
"You're not?"
"No. I don't think I should have to. If I tell you I've got reasons, it should be enough. If you love me like you say you do."
Her manner was so vehement, and the stand she was taking so inflexible and unexpected, that I was too surprised to be angry. "Okay, okay," I said reasonably. "Let's try this again. I have to go back to Bombay, so why don't you come with me, and then we'll be together. Forever and ever, amen."
"I won't go back," she said flatly.
"Why the hell not?"
"I can't. I just don't want to, and I don't want you to either."
"Well, I don't see the problem. I can do what I have to do in Bombay, and you can wait here. I'll come back when it's all done."
I don't want you to go, she repeated in that same monotone.
Come on, Carla, I have to go back.
No, you don't.
My smile curled into a frown. Yes, I do. I promised Ulla I'd be back in 10 days. She's still in trouble, you know that.
Ulla can look after herself, she hissed,
still refusing to turn and look at me. Are you jealous of Ulla? I asked, grinning, as I reached out to stroke her hair.
Oh, don't be stupid, she snapped.
She turned, and there was fury in her eyes.
I like Ulla, but I'm telling you, she can take care of herself.
Take it easy. What's the matter? You knew I was going back. We've talked about this. I'm getting into the passport business. You know how important that is for me.
I'll get you a passport. I'll get you 5 passports.
My stubbornness began to rouse itself. I don't want you to get me a passport. I want to learn how to make them and change them myself. I want to learn it all, everything I can. They're going to teach me how to fix passports and forge them. If I learn that, I'll be free. And I want to be free, Carla. Free. That's what I want.
Why should you be any different? She demanded.
What do you mean?
Nobody gets what they want, she said. Nobody does. Nobody.
Her fury dimmed into something worse. Something I'd never seen in her. A resigned and defeated sorrow. I knew it was a sin to put such a feeling in such a woman. In any woman. And I knew, watching her little smile fade and die, that sooner or later I would pay for it. I spoke to her softly, slowly, trying to win her agreement. I sent Ulla to my friend, Abdullah's. He's looking after her. I can't just leave her there. I have to go back.
I won't be here when you look for me next time, she said,
turning to lean against the doorway once more. What's that supposed to mean?
Just what I said.
Is that some kind of threat? Is that an ultimatum?
You can call it what you like,
she answered dully, as if waking from a dream.
It's just a fact. If you go back to Bombay, I'll give up on you. I won't go with you, and I won't wait for you. Stay with me now, here, or go back alone. The choice is yours. But if you go back, it will finish us.
I stared at her, bewildered and angry and in love. You have to give me more than that, I said, more softly. You've got to tell me why. You've got to talk to me, Carla. You can't just give me an ultimatum without any reason and expect me to go along with it. There's a difference between a choice and an ultimatum. A choice means that you know what's going on and why before you decide. I'm not the kind of man you can give an ultimatum to. If I was, I wouldn't have escaped from jail. You can't tell me what to do, Carla. You can't order me to do something without an explanation. I'm not that kind of man. You've got to tell me what's going on.
I can't.
I sighed and spoke evenly, but my teeth were clenched. I don't think I'm doing a very good job of explaining this. The fact is, there isn't a lot that I respect about myself, but the little bit that I've still got left, it's all I've got. A man has to respect himself, Carla, before he can respect anyone else. If I just give in and do whatever you want me to do without any kind of reason, I wouldn't respect myself. And if you tell the truth, you wouldn't respect me either. So I'm asking you again, what's all this about?
I can't.
You mean you won't?
I mean, I can't,
she said softly. And then she looked straight into my eyes.
And I won't. That's just how it is. You told me just a little while ago that you would do anything for me. I want you to stay here. I don't want you to go back to Bombay. If you do go back, it's all over between us.
What kind of a man would I be? I asked, trying to smile. If I went along with that.
I guess that's your answer. And you've made your choice, she sighed,
pushing past me to walk out of the hut. I packed my bag and strapped it to the bike. When all was ready, I went down to the sea. She rose from the waves and walked toward me slowly, dragging her feet through the shifting sand. The singlet and lungi clung to her body. Her black hair gleamed, sleek and wet under the soaring sun. The most beautiful woman I'd ever seen. I love you, I said, as she came into my arms and we kissed. I spoke the words against her lips, her face, her eyes. I held her close to me. I love you. It'll be okay. You'll see. I'll be back soon.
No,
she answered woodenly, her body not stiff but utterly still, the life and the love drained out of it.
It won't be all right. It won't be okay. It's over. And I won't be here after today.
I looked into her eyes and felt my own body harden, hollowed out by pride. My hands fell from her shoulders. I turned and walked back to the bike. Riding to the last little cliff that gave a view of the beach, our beach, I stopped the bike and shielded my eyes to look for her. But she was gone. There was nothing but the waves, breaking like the curved spines of playful porpoises, and the traceless, empty, tousled sheets of sand.
Chapter 25. A smiling servant opened the door and ushered me into the room, gesturing for me to be silent. He needn't have bothered. The music was so loud in the room that I couldn't have been heard even if I'd shouted. Cupping his hand as if it were a saucer and pretending to sip from it, he mimed an offer of chai. I nodded. He closed the door behind him quietly, leaving me alone with Abdul Ghani. The portly figure stood in the broad curve of a high bay window, looking out at a wide view of roof garden plateaus, balconies ablaze with green and yellow saris hung out to dry, and rust-red herringbone rooftops. The room was huge. Ornate ceiling rosettes surrounded thick gold suspension chains for three elaborate chandeliers on the distant ceiling. At the end of the room, near the main door, there was a long dining table with 12 high-backed teak chairs. A mahogany armoire ran the length of the table against one wall and was topped by an immense rose-glass mirror. Beside the armoire, there was a floor-to-ceiling bookcase running the further length of the wall. On the opposite long wall of the room, four tall windows looked upon the uppermost branches and cool shading leaves of plane trees lining the street below. The center of the room, between the wall of books and the tall windows, was set up as an office. A teak and leather captain's chair, facing the main door, served a broad, baroque desk. The far end of the room was decorated for entertaining, with leather Chesterfields and deep armchairs. Two enormous bay windows in the end wall, behind the couches, dominated the room with arches of brilliant sunlight. French doors set into the two bay windows opened onto a wide balcony, giving the view of Colaba's inner-city rooftop gardens, clotheslines, and neglected gargoyles. Abdul Ghani stood there, listening to the music and singing that thundered from an expensive sound system built into the wall of books. The voices and the music were familiar, and a few moments of concentration brought them back to me. They were the blind singers,
the same men I'd heard as Kadirbai's guest on the first night that I met him. The song wasn't one I recalled from that concert, but I was struck at once by its passion and power. As the thrilling, heart-wrenching chorus of voices finished, we stood in a throbbing silence that seemed to resist the noises of the households within the building and of the street below us.
"Do you know them?" he asked, without turning around.
"Yes, they're the Blind Singers, I think."
"Indeed they are," he said,
in the mix of Indian lilt and BBC newsreader's tone that I'd come to enjoy.
"I love their music, Lynn, more than anything I have ever heard, from any culture. But in the heart of my love for it, I have to say that I am afraid. Every time I hear them, and I play them every day when I am at home here, I have the feeling that I am hearing the sound of my own requiem."
He still hadn't turned to face me, and I remained standing near the center of the long room.
That must be unsettling.
"Unsettling," he said softly. "Yes. Yes, it is unsettling. Tell me, Lynn, do you think that one great act of genius can allow us to forgive the 100 flaws and failures that bring it into being?"
"It's hard to say. I'm not exactly sure what you mean, but I guess it depends on how many people benefit by it and how many people get hurt."
He turned to face me, and I saw that he was crying. Tears rolled quickly, easily, and continuously from his large eyes and spilled across the plump cheeks to the belly of his long silk shirt. His voice, however, was calm and composed.
"Did you know that our Majid was killed last night?"
"No,"
I frowned, shocked by the news.
"Killed?"
"Yes, murdered. Slaughtered like some beast in his own house. His body was torn to pieces, and the pieces were found in many different rooms of the house. The name Shapna was daubed on the walls with his own blood. Police are blaming fanatics who follow this Shapna. I'm sorry, Lynn. Forgive my tears, please. I'm afraid that this bad business has taken its toll on me."
"No, not at all. I'll come back at another time."
"Of course not. You're here now, and Kader is anxious for you to begin. We'll drink tea and I will pull myself together, and then we'll examine the passport business, you and I."
He walked to the hi-fi set and extracted the cassette tape of the Blind Singers. Sliding it into a gold plastic case, he approached me and pressed it into my hands.
"I want you to have this as a present from me," he said, his eyes and cheeks still wet with tears. "It's time I stopped listening to it, and I feel sure that you will enjoy it."
"Thank you,"
I muttered, almost as confused by the gift as I was by the news of Majid's death.
"Not at all, Lynn. Come, sit with me. You were in Goa, I believe. Do you know our young fighter, Andrew Ferreira? Yes? Then you know he is from Goa. He goes there often with Salman and Sanjay when I have work for them. You must all go there together sometime. They will show you the special sights, if you get my meaning. So, tell me, how was your trip?"
I answered him, trying to give my whole attention to the conversation, but my mind was thick with thoughts of Majid. Dead Majid. I couldn't say that I'd liked him, or even that I'd trusted him. Yet his death, his murder, shook me, and filled me with a strange, excited agitation. He'd been killed. Slaughtered, Abdul had said, in the house at Juhu, where we'd studied together. And he'd taught me about gold and golden crimes. I thought of the house. I remembered its view of the sea, its purple-tiled swimming pool, its bare, pale green prayer room where Majid had bent his ancient knees 5 times every day and touched his bushy grey eyebrows to the floor. I remembered sitting outside that room
near the pool, waiting for him as he took time out to pray. I remembered staring at the purple water as the murmured syllables of the prayers buzzed past me into the swaying fronds of palms leaning in around the pool. And once again I had the sense of a trap, of a destiny not shaped by my own deeds and desires. It was as if the constellations themselves were just the outlines of an immense cage that revolved and realigned itself, inscrutably, until the single moment that fate had reserved for me. There was too much that I didn't understand. There was too much that I wouldn't allow myself to ask. And I was excited in that web of connections and concealments. The scent of danger, the smell of fear, filled my senses. The heart-squeezing, enlivening exhilaration of it was so powerful that it wasn't until an hour later, when we entered Abdul Ghani's passport workshop, that I could give my full attention to the man and the moment that we shared. "This is Krishna, and this is Vilu," Ghani said, introducing me to two short, slender, dark-skinned men who resembled one another so closely that I thought they might be brothers. "There are many experts in this business, many men and women with a detective's eye for detail and a surgeon's confident steadiness of hand. But my experience of 10 years in the counterfeiting arts tells me that the Sri Lankans, such as our Krishna and Vilu, are the best forgers in the world." The men smiled widely, with perfect white teeth, in response to the compliment. They were handsome men, their faces formed from fine, almost delicate features, in a harmony of gentle contours and curves. They returned to their work as we strolled about the large room. "This is the light box," Abdul Ghani explained, waving his plump hand at a long table. It was topped with white opaque glass. Strong lights shone from within its frame. "Krishna is our best lightbox man. He examines the pages of genuine passports, looking for watermarks and concealed patterns. In this way, he can duplicate these effects where we need them." I bent over Krishna's shoulder to watch him as he studied the information page of a British passport. A complex pattern of wavy lines descended from the top of the page, across a photograph, and onto the bottom of the page. On another passport beside it, Krishna was matching the pattern of wavy lines on the edge of a substituted photograph, creating the lines with a fine-tipped pen. Using the light box, he placed one pattern over the other to check for irregularities. "Vilu is our best stamp man," Abdul Ghani said, guiding me to another long table. On a rack at the back of the table, there were rows of many more rubber stamps. "Vilu can make any stamp, no matter how intricate its design. Visa stamps, exit and entry, special permission stamps, whatever we need. He has 3 new profile cutting machines for reproducing the stamps. The machines cost me dearly. I had to import them all the way from Germany. And I spent almost as much again in Bakshish, getting them through customs controls and into our workshop without any unpleasant questions. But our Vilu is an artist, and he often prefers to ignore my beautiful machines and cut the new stamps by hand." I watched as Vilu created a new stamp on a blank rubber template. He copied a photographic enlargement of the original, a departure stamp from Athens Airport, and cut the new stamp with scalpels and jeweler's files. Inkpad tests of the new stamp revealed minor flaws. When those were finally eradicated, Vilu used a scrap of wet and dry sandpaper to wear away one corner of the stamp. That deliberate imperfection gave the inked image a genuine, natural appearance on the page. The completed stamp joined scores of others in the rack of stamps, waiting to be used on newly altered passports. Abdul Ghani completed his tour of the factory, demonstrating the computers, photocopy equipment, printing presses, profile cutters, and reserves of special parchment papers and inks. When I'd seen all there was to see on a first visit, he offered me a lift back to Colaba. I declined, asking him if I might stay and spend some time with the Sri Lankan forgers. He seemed pleased with my enthusiasm, or perhaps simply amused.
when he left me, I heard his heavy sigh as the sadness of bereavement claimed him once more. Krishna, Vilu, and I drank chai and talked for 3 hours without a pause. Although they weren't brothers, they were both Tamil Sri Lankans who came from the same village on the Jaffna Peninsula. Conflict between the Tamil Tigers, the Liberation Tigers for Tamil Eelam, and the Sri Lankan army had obliterated their village. Almost all the members of both families were dead. The two young men escaped with Vilu's sister, a cousin, Krishna's grandparents, and his two young nieces, who were under 5 years old. A fishing boat brought them to India on the people smuggling route between Jaffna and the Coromandel coast. They made their way to Bombay and then lived on a footpath under a sheet of plastic as pavement dwellers. They'd survived that first year by taking ill-paid jobs as day labourers and by committing a variety of petty crimes. Then one day, a footpath neighbour, who'd learned that they could read and write well in English, asked them to change a licence document. Their work was good, and it brought a steadily increasing stream of visitors to their plastic awning on the Bombay footpath. Hearing of their skill, Abdul Ghani had recommended to Kadarbai that they be given a chance to prove themselves. 2 years later, at the time that I met them, Krishna and Vilu shared a large, comfortable apartment with the surviving members of their two families, saved money from their generous salaries, and were arguably the most successful forgers in Bombay, India's counterfeiting capital. I wanted to learn everything. I wanted the mobility and security that their passport skills offered me. They spoke English well. My enthusiasm fueled their natural congeniality, and that first conversation flowed with good humour. It was a propitious start to the new friendship. I visited Krishna and Vilu every day for a week after that meeting. The young men worked long hours, and on some days I remained with them for 10 hours at a stretch, watching them work and asking my several hundred questions. The passports that they worked on fell into two main groups: those they obtained as genuine used passports, and those that were blank and unused. The used passports had been stolen by pickpockets, lost by tourists, or sold by desperate junkies from Europe, Africa, the Americas, and Oceania. The blank passports were rare. They'd been sold by corrupt officials at consulates and embassies and departments of immigration, from France to Turkey to China. Those that found their way into Kadarbai's area of influence were bought immediately at any price and given to Krishna and Vilu. They showed me a blank, original, unused passport from Canada as an example. It was housed in a fireproof safe with others from the United Kingdom, Germany, Portugal, and Venezuela. With sufficient patience, expertise, and resources, the two forgers could change almost anything in a passport to suit a new user's requirements. Photographs were substituted, and the ridge marks or indentations of a heavy stamp were imitated, using something as humble as a crochet hook. Sometimes the stitching that bound a passport was carefully removed, and whole groups of pages were replaced using clean pages from a second passport. Dates, details, and stamps were all altered or erased with chemical solvents. New data was inserted in an appropriate shade, selected from a comprehensive catalogue of printer's inks. Some of the changes defied the scrutiny of experts, and none of them was detectable in routine examinations. During that first week of passport studies, I found a new, safe, comfortable apartment for Ulla in neighbouring Tardeo, not far from the Haji Ali Mosque. Lisa Carter, who'd visited Ulla almost every day at Abdullah's apartment, and visited far more warmly with Abdullah himself, agreed to share the new place. We moved them and their belongings in a small fleet of taxis. The two women liked one another and got on well. They drank vodka, cheated at Scrabble and gin rummy, enjoyed the same kinds of movies on video, and swapped clothes. They'd also discovered, in the weeks they'd spent in Abdullah's surprisingly well-stocked kitchen, that they liked one another's cooking. The new apartment was a new beginning for them. And despite Ulla's lingering fears about Maurizio and his crooked deals, she and Lisa
were happy and optimistic. I continued the weight training and karate with Abdullah, Salman and Sanjay. We were fit and strong and fast. And as the days of training became weeks, Abdullah and I grew closer as friends and brothers, just as Salman and Sanjay were with one another. It was the kind of closeness that didn't need conversation to sustain itself. Quite often we would meet, travel to the gym, work out on the weights, box a few rounds, spend half an hour sparring at karate, and speak no more than 10 words to one another. Sometimes, with no more than a look in my eye or an unusual expression on his face, we would laugh and keep on laughing so hard that we collapsed to the practice mat. And in that way, without words, I slowly opened my heart to Abdullah, and I began to love him. I'd spoken to the head man of the slum, Kasim Ali Hussein, and to several others, including Johnny Cigar, when I'd first returned from Goa. I saw Prabhakar in his taxi every other day. But there were so many new challenges and rewards in Ghani's passport workshop, and they kept me so busy and excited that I stopped working even occasionally at the slum clinic I'd founded in the little hut that had been my home. On my first visit to the slum in several weeks, I was surprised to find Prabhakar in the wriggling convulsions of a dance while the slum musicians were rehearsing one of their popular songs. The little guide was dressed in his taxi driver's khaki shirt and white trousers. He wore a purple scarf around his neck and yellow plastic sandals. Approaching him unobserved, I watched him in silence for a while. His dance managed to combine obscenely lewd and suggestive thrusts of his hips with the facial expressions and hand-whirling gestures of a childlike innocence. With clownish charm, he held his open palms beside his smiling face one moment, and then pumped his groin back and forth with a determined little grimace the next. When he finally turned and saw me, his face exploded in that huge smile, that uniquely wide and heart-filled smile, and he rushed to greet me. "Oh, Lin," he cried, squeezing his head into my chest in an affectionate hug. "I have a news for you. I have it such a fantastic news. I was looking for you in every place, every hotel with naked ladies, every drinking bar with black market peoples, every dirty slum, every..."
"I get the picture, Prabhu. So what's your news?"
"I am to be getting married. I am making a marriage on Parvati. Can you believe it?"
"Sure I can believe it. Congratulations. I take it you were practicing just now for the wedding party."
"Oh, yes,"
he agreed, lunging at me with his hips a few times.
"I want a very sexy dancing for everybody at the party. It's a pretty good sexy, isn't it?"
"It's sexy, sure. How are things here?"
"Very fine, no problem. Oh, Lin, I forgot. Johnny, he is making a marriage also. He will be marrying with Sita, the sister of my own beautiful Parvati."
"Where is he? I want to say hello."
"He is down at the seashore, you know, at the place where he sits on the rocks for being lonely. The same place where you also enjoy a good lonely. You'll find him there."
I walked off, glancing back over my shoulder to see Prabhakar encouraging the band with mechanical piston-like thrusts of his narrow hips. At the edge of the slum, where black boulders tumbled to the sea, I found Johnny Cigar. He was dressed in a white singlet and a checkered green lungi. He braced himself with his arms, leaning back and staring out to sea. It was almost exactly the same spot where he'd told me about seawater sweat and tears on the evening of the cholera outbreak, so many months before. "Congratulations," I said, sitting beside him and offering him a beady cigarette.
"Thanks, Lin,"
he smiled, shaking his head. I put the packet away, and for a while we both watched the small, petulant waves smack at the rocky shore.
"You know, I was brought into this life, conceived, I mean, not born, just over there, in the Navy Naga," he said, nodding his head toward the compound of the Indian Navy.
A curve of coastline separated us from the Naga, but a direct line of sight across the small bay gave us a clear view of the houses, huts, and barracks.
My mother was from Delhi side originally. Her family, they were all Christians. They made good money in the service of the British, but they lost their position and their privileges after the independence. They moved to Bombay when my mother was 15 years old. Her father took employment with the Navy, working as a clerk. They lived in a Jhopadpatti near here. My mother fell in love with a sailor. He was a tall young fellow from Amritsar, with the best mustache in the whole Nagar. When she became pregnant with me, her family threw her out. She tried to get some help from the sailor, who was my father, but he left the Nagar, and she never saw him or heard about him again.
He paused, breathing through his nose, with his lips pressed tightly together. His eyes squinted against the glare from the glittering sea and the fresh, persistent breeze. Behind us, we could hear the noises of the slum. Hawkers' cries, the slap of clothes on stone in the washing area, children playing, a bickering complaint, and the jangling music for Prabhakar's piston hips.
She had a tough time of it, Lynn. She was heavily pregnant with me when they threw her out. She moved to a pavement dweller settlement across in Crawford Market area and wore the widow's white sari, pretending that she'd had a husband and pretending that he was dead. She had to do that. She had to become a widow for life before she was even married. That's why I never got married. I'm 38 years old. I can read and write very well. My mother made sure I was educated. And I do the bookwork for all the shops and businesses in the slum. I do the taxes for every man who pays them. I make a good living here, and I have respect. I should have been married 15 or even 20 years ago. But she was a widow all her life for me. And I couldn't do it. I just couldn't allow myself to get married. I kept hoping I would see him, the sailor with the best mustache. My mother had one very old faded photograph of the two of them, looking very serious and stern. That's why I lived in this area. I always hoped I would see him. And I never married. And she died last week, Lynn. My mother died last week.
He turned to me, and the whites of his eyes were blazing with the tears he wouldn't let them shed.
She died last week, and now I'm getting married.
I'm sorry to hear about your mother, Johnny, but I'm sure she'd want you to get married. I think you'll make a good father. In fact, I know you'll make a good father. I'm sure of it. He looked at me, his eyes talking to me, in a language I could feel but couldn't understand. When I left him, he was staring at the ceaselessness of the sea, irritated to checkered white rifts by the wind. I walked back through the slum to the clinic. A conversation with Ayub and Siddhartha, the two young men I'd trained to run the clinic, reassured me that all was well. I gave them some money to keep as an emergency float, and left money with Prabhakar for his wedding preparations. I paid a courtesy visit to Kasim Ali Hussein, allowing him to force the hospitality of chai upon me. Jitendra and Anand Rao, two of my former neighbours, joined us, with several other men I knew well. Kasim Ali led the conversation, referring to his son Sadiq, who was working in the Gulf. In turn, we spoke of religious and communal conflict in the city, the construction of the Twin Towers, still at least 2 years from completion, and the weddings of Prabhakar and Johnny Sagar. It was a genial, sanguine meeting, and I rose to leave with the strength and confidence that those honest, simple, decent men always inspired in me. I'd only walked a few paces, however, when the young Sikh, Anand Rao, caught up and fell into step beside me.
"Lin Baba, there is a problem here," he said quietly.
He was an unusually solemn man at the best of times, but at that moment his expression was unambiguously grim.
"That Rashid, that fellow I used to be sharing with, do you remember?"
Yes, Rashid. I remember him, I replied, recalling the thin, bearded face and restless, guilty eyes of the man who'd been my neighbour, with Anand, for more than a year.
He's making a bad business, Anand Rao declared bluntly. His wife and her sister came from their native place. They went from that hut when they came. He has been living with them alone now for some time.
And what? I asked, as we walked out onto the road together. I had no idea what Anand Rao was driving at, and I had no patience for it. It was the kind of vague, insinuated complaint that had come to me almost every day when I'd lived in the slum. Most of the time, such complaints came to nothing. Most of the time, it was in my best interests to have nothing to do with them.
Well,
Anand Rao hesitated, perhaps sensing my impatience.
It is... He is... Something is very bad, and I am... There must be...
He fell silent, staring at his sandaled feet. I reached out to put a hand on his broad, proud, thin shoulder. Gradually his eyes lifted and met mine in a mute appeal. Is it money? I asked, reaching into my pocket. Do you need some money? He recoiled as if I'd cursed him. He held the stare for a moment before turning and walking back into the slum. I strode on through familiar streets and told myself that it was okay. Anand Rao and Rashid had shared a hut for more than 2 years. If they were falling out because Rashid's wife and her sister had moved to the city, and Anand had been forced from the hut, it was probably to be expected, and it was no business of mine. I laughed, shaking my head as I walked, and trying to figure out why Anand Rao had reacted so badly to the offer of money. It wasn't an unreasonable thing for me to assume or to offer. On the 30-minute walk from the slum to Leopold, I gave money to 5 other people, including both of the Zodiac Georges. He'll get over it, whatever it is, I told myself. At any rate, it's got nothing to do with me. But the lies we tell ourselves are the ghosts that haunt the empty house of midnight. And although I pushed Anand and the slum from my mind, I felt the breath of that ghosted lie on my face as I walked through the long, thronging causeway on that hot afternoon. I stepped up into Leopold's, and Didier seized me by the arm before I could speak or sit down, turning me about and leading me to a cab that was waiting outside.
I have searched for you everywhere, Didier puffed as the cab pulled out from the curb. I have been to the most unspeakably foul places looking for you.
People keep telling me that.
Well, Lin, you really must try to spend more time in places where they serve a decent alcohol. It may not make the finding of you easier, but it will make it far more pleasant.
Where are we going, Didier?
Vikram's great strategy. My own superb strategy, if you please. For the capture of Letitia's cold and stony little English heart unfolds now, even as we speak.
Yeah, well, I wish him all the best, I frowned. But I'm hungry. I was about to make very loud noises in a plate of Leopold's pulao. You can let me off here.
But no, it is not possible, Didier objected. Letitia, she is a very stubborn woman. She would refuse gold and diamonds if someone insisted that she should take them. She will not participate in the strategy unless someone convinces her. Someone like you, my friend. And this must be achieved in the next half hour. At exactly 6 minutes after 3 o'clock.
What makes you think Letty will listen to me?
You are the only one of us she does not now hate, or has not hated at some time in the past. For Letitia, the statement, I do not hate you, is a poem of passionate love. She will listen to you, I am sure of it. And without you, the plan will fail. And the good Vikram, as if loving such a woman as our Letitia was not sufficient to prove his mental derangement. He has already risked his life several times to make the plan possible. You cannot imagine how much preparation we have made, Vikram and I, for just this moment.
Well, nobody told me anything about it, I complained, still thinking of the delicious pulao at Leopold.
But that is exactly why I have searched for you all over Colaba, You have no choice, Lin. You must help him. I know you. There is in you, as there is in me,